Chapter 49. Gly cursed himself for taking such a foolish risk, but lying under one of the rusting lifeboats, he could not observe in any detail the activity taking place down in the hole where the salvage team was laboring. The idea of mingling with them seemed absurdly simple, though dangerous. He noted there was only a slight difference in the style of his thermal exposure suit and theirs. The air tanks strapped to his back were of an earlier model, but the color was the same. Who would notice a near look-alike interloper in the murk? He swam down and approached from one side until his fins scraped against something solid, a steel hatch cover torn loose and resting on the deck. Before he could figure out his next move, one of the salvage crew drifted over and pointed down at the hatch. Gly gave an exaggerated nod of his head in understanding, and together the two of them wrestled the heavy steel plate to the bulwarks and heaved it over the side. There were no invisible perils here. Gly recognized the threat and kept a wary eye. He pitched in with the others as though he had been doing it from the start. It was, to his way of thinking, a classic case of the most obvious being the least obvious. They were much farther along than he had imagined. The Pneuma people were like miners who seemed to know exactly where the mother lode was located, and they dug their shaft accordingly. By his calculation, they were removing a ton of scrap every 3 hours. He kicked across the cavity, taking an approximate measurement of its width. The next two questions were, how deep were they going, and how long would it take them to get there? Then he sensed that something was out of place, an impression more fancied than evident. Nothing looked to be out of the ordinary. The salvage men seemed too involved with their work to notice Gly. Yet there was a subtle change. Gly moved into the shadows and floated immobile, breathing shallowly and evenly. He listened to the magnified underwater sounds and watched the animated movements of the gym suits. His overworked sixth sense told him it was time to fade away. But he was too late. What was imperceptible a moment before came through with glassy transparency now. The other divers looked busy, but they were accomplishing nothing. The grappling claw had not returned after snatching its last load. The saturation divers lazily poked at the debris but did not transfer any of it over the side. Slowly, with clairvoyant cooperation, they had gradually formed a crescent around Gly. Then it dawned on him. His presence had been detected from the mothership. He had failed to catch the TV cameras attached to the lights because they were hidden by the glare. Nor did he realize until now that the salvagers could receive instructions from a command center through miniaturized receivers inside their hoods. He retreated until his back flattened against a bulkhead. The gym suits formed a barrier in front of him while the other divers hovered on the flanks, closing off the final avenues of escape. They were all gazing at him now and unemotional. Gly unsheathed an 8-inch knife and crouched, thrusting it palm up in the non-professional but still lethal stance of a street fighter. It was a futile gesture born from a reflex action. The other divers carried knives too, nasty stainless steel blades strapped to their legs. And the manipulator clamps of the gym suits possessed an inhuman strength to make painful wounds indeed. They gathered around him motionless, like statues in a graveyard. Then one of the divers took a plastic slate from his weight belt and briefly wrote on it with a yellow grease stick. He finished and held the slate in front of Gly's nose. The message was short and to the point. It simply read, "Kiss off." For a moment, Gly was stunned. This was not the reception he expected. Not waiting to be cajoled, he flexed his knees and launched his body upward, swimming strongly over the Pneuma divers' heads. They made not the slightest effort to stop him, moving only to turn and watch him melt into the blackness. "You let him go," Gunn said quietly. "Yes, I let him go." "Do you think it was wise?" Pitt stood impassive and did not immediately answer, his incredible green eyes narrowed in conjecture. There was a smile, but not a smile. The expression was almost menacing, that of a lion waiting in cover for a passing meal. "You saw the knife," Pitt said at last. "He didn't have a prayer. Our boys would have fed him to the fish." The man was a killer. It was a simple statement, nothing more. We can still pick him up when he surfaces, Gunn persisted. He would be helpless then. I don't think so. Any particular thought in mind? Elementary, said Pitt. We use a small fish to catch a big one. So that's it, eh? Gunn said, unconvinced. Wait until he meets up with his buddies, form a posse, and round up the lot. Then turn them over to the authorities. For all we know, they are the authorities. Gunn was more confused than ever. So what's the percentage? Our visitor was only on a scout mission. Next time he might bring some friends and really get nasty. We need to buy time. I think it would be worth our while to stop their clock. Gunn made a peculiar twist with his lips and nodded. I'm with you, but we had better get a move on. That guy will be boarding the next boat that passes by. No rush, Pitt said, quite relaxed. He'll have to decompress for at least a half an hour. Probably has a spare set of air cylinders stashed on the river bottom somewhere. Another question formed in Gunn's mind. You said the gatecrasher was a killer. What made you say that? He was too quick with the knife, too anxious to use it. Those who are born with a killer instinct never hesitate. So we're up against people with a license to kill, said Gunn thoughtfully. Not exactly a cozy thought.